nobody, including Professor Noakes, is saying that low carb, high fat is the only way. What they are saying, if you listen closely, is that this is a very effective option to treat chronic diseases of lifestyle. And the biggest message coming out from these people is that a diet-related disease requires diet-related solutions before you go for drugs as first resort.
Throughout human history, from Galileo to Einstein, those with vision and the ability to look beyond dogma have come under fire from their peers and those who stand to lose credibility in the wake of new discoveries. It takes a committed and brave individual to stand up and admit that conventional wisdom may in fact be flawed. In 2014, Professor Tim Noakes was reported to the Health Professionals Council of South Africa for giving unconventional dietary advice on a social media platform. He was advocating a natural whole food diet in a tweet. Most South Africans, especially those with even a remote interest in health, know of Professor Noakes. He is, after all, a household name in the world of sport and nutrition. I've often wondered, had the hearing never taken place, would the high-fat, low-carb protocol have gained such infamy? Although the trial was a personal and professional blow at the time, it did serve to shine a spotlight into many areas in the health and academic arena that otherwise would have remained behind closed doors. The hearing quite literally transformed the way the public understood diet and nutrition and made an already famous scientist infamous, and garnered him worldwide support that he may never otherwise have been afforded. In this episode, I chat with journalist Mariko Sparros, co-author with Professor Tim Noakes of The Law of Nutrition, Challenging Conventional Dietary Beliefs, published by Penguin in 2015. The book covers all the details of the hearing and subsequent trial. Mariko started her career as a hard news reporter for the Rand Daily Mail in the 1970s, covering criminal trials, politics, and religion. She later became a features and investigative writer on women's health issues. Mariko worked for the Star newspaper and the Business Day, where she edited a weekly publication called Health News for 8 years. She's also founder and editor of the foodmed.net website. Mariko gives a fascinating first-person account of the hearing, including her opinions on academic bullying. For more gory details about the trial and the characters who played a part in attempting to discredit one of the greatest minds of our time, the book is available everywhere you can buy a book. Please visit the links in the podcast notes to find out more. I'm hoping that if you get anything from this discussion, it would be to always question, be open to new discoveries, and if the advice you've been given isn't working, change your strategy. I hope you enjoy.
Well, I must say it's been absolutely fascinating watching how a first world deals totally irrationally with COVID compared to how a developing world in South Africa is dealing absolutely irrationally with COVID. Personally, lockdown, although my personal view is that draconian lockdowns don't work, mostly, as I wrote on my website, which I think was quite prescient and I'm proud of, even though I'm not a virologist or any kind of medical doctor or an economist, is that the biggest threat that we were facing from the outset was not the virus itself, but the economic fallout. And so it's proving to be, especially in South Africa, but also in England. And from a personal point of view, I'm definitely in an age group that is at greater risk. But I've also been watching with great interest all the evidence showing the link between people who have a terrible time if they get infected, or even in worst case scenario, die, and those who have underlying conditions, particularly metabolic. Any doctor who has suggested that, or scientist, has been subject to the usual trolling and attack, when the reality is that, excuse me, nobody really knows what the real causes are that kills some people and doesn't kill others, and just how deadly this virus is. I saw something recently, a doctor who had all the qualifications you could ask for to comment and say something like this, that this virus is far more deadly than a lot of people think or are being encouraged to think. And I say that advisedly, because I've been very, very disturbed by the misinformation that is coming from quarters, establishment quarters, who really should know better, as if they know they have all the answers. And that, you know, yes, there are risk groups that make people more vulnerable. And then you have far too many outliers for comfort. Young people who are shown afterwards to have had no underlying medical conditions, even metabolic conditions, who have died. So you know, it's been a very interesting experience for me. At not able to fly back yet, unless I'm prepared to pay a lot of money, which I don't think it is reasonable to ask of me right now. But also, I would be flying back into absolute mayhem in my beloved country, and have to go into government quarantine for 2 weeks, which I don't want to do, because I don't think that, while my age puts me in a risk group, there are other factors that I think protect me from it. And you, how are you doing?
Well, on my side, all good, thank goodness, at the moment. But like you said, we're reaching our peak now, unlike Europe and America, excuse me, who reached their peak in March, April. So we've still got it coming here. So it's probably safer to stay somewhere that's, you know, in Europe in the warmer weather. It is your best bet, because, yeah, over the last probably 2 weeks, we've seen the peak happen. And it is getting out of control, like it was everywhere else in the world, as predicted. But what do you do? We've seen the damage that the lockdown caused economically as well, and it's not sustainable. We can't choose between one and another.
Mildly, yes, and not so much peaking as surging. I mean, the peak hasn't quite, well, what I understand as a peak is starting to flatten in Gauteng, from what I hear, which is where I live. That's where my home is. But, you know, for me, what really unnerved me was that we lost, my husband and I lost a very, very close friend, my husband's best friend in the world, about 6 weeks ago, and to the virus. And he was in Cape Town. He was 65, fit, healthy, didn't have any underlying metabolic conditions as far as we know. He did have elevated blood pressure, which is one of the risk factors, but he was being treated for it. Within 2 weeks, he was dead. And he was slim and healthy and fit, otherwise healthy, used to walk up Table Mountain every day with his dog. And he was affluent. He immediately, well, I mean, not immediately. The thing is that he was tested and the test showed negative, although he had all the symptoms. And it later turned out that the only place he'd been to, he was observing all the lockdown regs very closely. And he'd been to a pharmacy in Tambo's Kloof where he lived. A few days later, started showing symptoms. And I read that the pharmacy would later close down because the staff in the pharmacy were infected. But he had tests and showed negative. So he went into denial and just, you know, persuaded himself that he didn't have it. He didn't really want to have it. And then he went into hospital late. The news just got worse and worse. And then I heard that he was going to be ventilated. And in my heart, I knew that he was going to die. And it's not, you know, all the scare stories about ventilation, you know, ventilation kills. From what I've heard, it's not the ventilation that kills, although it's a very invasive procedure. And it's not something that you want to have done, and it doesn't, it hasn't got a great record. You know, I must be careful of what I say because I'm talking very much as a lay person. Ventilation is very often a sign of things being too late. And so it's not the ventilation that kills you. Even if you weren't ventilated, you would still, in many cases, these people would have died. It's been absolutely fascinating to watch all the trolls, the MD, I call them the usual suspects, because I can predict with practically 100% certainty which of the doctors and dietitians are going to come out in force and attack anybody, any doctor or scientist who dares to say something that even vaguely goes against dogma, even on treating COVID, you know, which is sure. which would be very funny were it not so deadly serious, because the reality is, as is becoming very, very clear, is that nobody really knows. And you know, on BBC Africa today, the South African TV presenter was saying, you know, until there is a cure, a vaccine is the only way to protect people from this virus. And you know, instinctively, without being a medical doctor or a scientist or a virologist or any sort of health professional, I, as a journalist, you know, my instinct is to say, for heaven's sake, you know, that's just nonsense. Because you know, the best way to protect people is from any infection. It just makes common sense. But of course, common sense is no longer common. Hasn't been for a long time. But the best way to protect people from any kind of infectious disease is to improve their underlying health status. One of the biggest underlying conditions that makes heart disease so dangerous for all of us is inflammation. Yes. Addressing once again, you can't just say inflammation causes heart disease. You have to look at the causes of inflammation. Malcolm Kendrick he's a GP, but he's made a very special study of heart disease, and he really is an expert. He's been writing reams and reams about the causes. And he thinks that, you know, of course diet is important, but he says that stress is so important when it comes to heart disease. You know, I've been going on all these absolutely fascinating journeys and meeting through writing, co-authoring the book with Tim Noakes, which was a dream for me as a journalist. Through that, I've got to meet all these amazing doctors and dietitians. I mean, in the beginning, I was starting to think, is there such a thing, you know, a progressive dietitian? It's an oxymoron. You know, I very quickly realized that that's just me being prejudiced. You know, there are very many, and there always have been, dietitians who have questioned. And one of my best ones is Dr. Karen Zinn. And she now lives, trained at UCT, and she now lives and practices in New Zealand. And she's an academic as well as in private practice. And in the beginning, she bought into the dogma that the high carb, low fat was the way to go. And then she worked with, she works with a scientist, Professor Grant Schofield. And when he said to her, you know, you need to start looking into low carb. And she was saying, you know, in the beginning, she just said, oh, no, it's unscientific. And then he had the same experience that I had and Tim had, is, you know, where has all this evidence been? And when I first heard about it through Tim Noakes, when I was talking to him and when he was telling me all this, I spoke to him for about 3 hours the first time around, because I knew him relatively well, having interviewed him many times on high carb and carbo loading as the best thing to do for sports performance. And when I heard, you know, I saw all these attacks on him in the media that he's gone rogue and he's crazy. And I thought, gee, you know, I always thought he was brilliant. And I phoned him and said, you know, can we have I'd like to interview you. Can I have a Skype interview? And he said, sure. And very polite, which he always has been, always is. And we spoke for about 3 hours, and he was so patient. And he said, you know, he gave me all the references. And as I was talking to him, my heart was starting to beat faster. And I was thinking, I really do hope that he's got things wrong, that he really is rogue. Because if he hasn't got things wrong, I have been guiding people in completely the wrong direction as a journalist for decades.
Yes.
And, you know, really? You know, if so, I must do more research. And I wasn't 100% sure. And I started doing the research, and I was really disturbed. I mean, so much so that a couple of days later, I phoned both my adult children. And I said, guys, I'm doing a mea culpa here. And I have to say, I am so sorry that I raised you guys on the wrong nutrition. You know, they just kind of laughed and said, look, you know, we were a hell of a lot healthier than our peers. And that was true to some extent. You know, I didn't give them as much kind of processed and refined white sugar. High carb, yes. Low fat, you know, I never gave them margarine, but I tried to keep a lid on butter. You know, I bought into it, and I was so angry. And with myself for not questioning, you know, I just, you know, do what I'm supposed to do as a journalist, which is, you know, I'm not the one to be saying what's right and what's wrong. I must speak to the experts. So I spoke to the experts and I reflected accurately what they said.
Yeah, we're taught to accept what we hear from so-called experts, not realizing that or not even thinking for a minute, what if they're misinformed? What if they are saying comes from a place of having had skewed information in the first place?
Science progresses by controversy and debate. You know, first people laugh at you, you know, then they go into denial. And then finally, when you are proved right, they say things like, oh, well, you know, we always, and dietitians are doing that too. So many dietitians who were hopelessly in big food and big pharma's pockets before are now saying, oh, but we always supported low carb.
Throughout human history, all visionaries and disruptors and people who went out and said, look, the emperor's not wearing any clothes, came up against opposition. And it seems as if you don't piss people off, you're not breaking frontiers. We can't toe the line. And, you know, for all the fault of social media, at least in some places, maybe we're getting the word out there. Because although the science side and the academics really came up against Noakes's new way of thinking, the public, who were essentially the guinea pigs for high carb, low fat, went, you know what? This has never worked. And this, what Professor Noakes is saying, is making a difference. So the non-academics, the people who were actually the victims of dieting through the 70s and the 80s, you know, in the early 90s, we're going, you know what, we agree. And it's going to be a process of time before this starts to gain, you know, momentum, I think.
Yes. No, I mean, a lot of what you say is correct. And talking about people as guinea pigs, that's really good terminology, because it has basically... the high carb, low fat was an experiment on unknowing participants worldwide. There was no scientific evidence backing up the high carb, low fat dietary guidelines when the US launched them onto an unsuspecting public in the late 1970s. And most English-speaking countries, including South Africa, began following and South Africa still slavishly follows those dietary guidelines still to this day. And nobody, including Professor Noakes, is saying that low-carb, high-fat is the only way. What they are saying, if you listen closely, is that this is a very effective option to treat chronic diseases of lifestyle. And the biggest message coming out from these people is that a diet-related disease requires diet-related solutions before you go for drugs as first resort. And again, you would think that that is a no-brainer. It's still not, although things have changed. And Professor Noakes's trial, although it put him through unbearable emotional as well as financial stress, and we can go into that a bit later, which I saw up close and personal, he has often said to me that looking back on it, he's glad that he went through the trial. He could have just withdrawn his registration as a medical doctor, and then the HPCSA wouldn't have had any jurisdiction against it over him. But knowing the forces ranged against him as I do, what they would have done is probably have held a hearing against him anyway and just found him guilty, because that's what they were intent on doing. But that trial was really important that he went through it. They put him through nearly 4.5 years of absolute hell, dragged his name through the mud internationally, made him a pariah, humiliated him, and eventually he got the outcome that he so hoped. First of all, although the committees who had to judge him were not actually judging him on the science, they showed that the HPCSA did not prove its case, and its case against him was that he was giving not only unconventional, supposed advice that went against convention, so, you know, unconventional, but that it was dangerous and that it was unscientific. And not only did they not prove it, but he deluged the hearing with robust evidence to the contrary. And three of his so-called angels flew in, one of them being Dr. Karen Zinn, who and she said something very interesting. Eventually, she said, in her opinion, it is unethical for dietitians who know about low-carb, high-fat not to offer it as an option for things like obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. There's some evidence even for cancer. But, you know, you start talking about cancer and nutrition, the trolls come out of the woodwork. If you ask me my professional opinion, from the research I've done, ketogenic diets can help patients, some patients with some cancers. It's not instead of conventional therapy. There's no evidence to show that.
So somebody a long time ago once said to me, imagine studying dietetics for years, perhaps doing a master's degree, and then finding out a couple of years later that everything you were taught was wrong and essentially propaganda, that everything you'd really, really sunk your teeth into and, you know, understood to be true was incorrect. And how would you respond? So when you threaten somebody's income by saying what you held to be the truth, and you have put that out there under the guise of helping people, is actually basically incorrect, most people are going to defend themselves irrespective of whether they're right or wrong. They don't give it any thought. They don't go, well, you know what? This is science. We're learning all the time. Let's move on. Let's do the best we can for people going forward. Very few people are capable of doing that. And whether it's doctors or dietitians or lawyers or teachers, you know, when you shake your world, it is hard to come back from that, unless you're a different kind of person who can deal with that.
fortunately, they're not in the majority, but there are many of those different sorts of people. And what they all have in common, when they are confronted with the evidence, robust evidence, that flatly contradicts a deeply held belief, no matter how long they've held it, they go with the evidence. That's what good scientists do. There's a phenomenon known as cognitive dissonance, and it's rampant. Cognitive dissonance, when they are confronted with robust evidence that flatly contradicts their deeply held beliefs that they've made a fortune from for decades, they go into a form of panic denial mode, and they just ignore the evidence. And that came up so strongly in Professor Noakes's trial. When I first started writing on it, you know, I was never paid me to write, hasn't ever paid me, wouldn't think of offering to pay me to write anything about him. I wouldn't accept it. I paid my own way to go down to Cape Town every time. And so I'm sitting there covering the trial, and I'm the only journalist. At the first hearing, I was thinking, he thinks that there's a coordinated campaign. Maybe he's exaggerating, because you know, there are a lot of people involved here, a lot of doctors, especially cardiologists. They can't all be going for him. And the first hearing, I thought, you know, I really think he's exaggerating. At the end of the first hearing, when I saw what the HPCSA got up to, and the head, as it later turned out, and that evidence only came out after he was found comprehensively not guilty. But at that time, when I heard what the head of dietetics at the HPCSA and the HPCSA itself was getting up to try and load the committee hearing, I was thinking, gee, there's a lot going on here that doesn't, you know, meet the eye. And so as a journalist, I became even more interested and thinking, you know, well, it looks like it's not a conspiracy theory. This is turning out to be conspiracy fact here. Let me dig a bit more. And what was very interesting for me was that I started speaking to the dietitian involved, who was the president of the Association for Dietetics. And I was speaking to her saying, you know, I'm sure you and ATSA all got a story to tell. You really believe that Professor Noakes has got it all wrong. Show me your evidence, because it would be such a good story for me as a journalist if I can say, guess what, you know, Professor Noakes really is wrong. It would just be a great story for me. And knowing Professor Noakes as I do, if they could show me the evidence that proves he's wrong, he would go with the evidence, because that's what a good scientist does. And so I'm saying to all these people, including the dietitian who had started the whole charade against him, and they couldn't. And I mean, you must hear Professor John Ioannidis, Stanford professor of medicine on nutrition research and epidemiology. He wrote a seminal article, some I think in 2008, saying why most published research is false. But he's recently, more recently, been going very big on epidemiology and nutrition research that relies on these food questionnaires. I mean, you're asking people to remember on a daily basis what they ate at last year, 10 years ago. And most people, they don't deliberately lie, although some people do because they want to present themselves well. They don't want anybody to know how much junk food they ate and how much processed sugar. But questionnaires are notoriously unreliable. And when I first started saying to them, guys, I know you've got a story to tell, and as a journalist, I want to tell it. I'm ready. You know, I'll let you see your quotes beforehand. All of a sudden, the walls came down. They blocked me and went silent. And, you know, as a journalist, when somebody slams the door in my face, my job is to go around the back door, to knock on the back door, to knock on the window, to see other avenues where I can get in and start asking questions. I went up to the highest levels. One of my contacts was a former journalist colleague. And I said to him, you know, I'm just speaking here as a journalist, and surely they want to respond. And he said, look, you know, I'll tell my boss I can't guarantee that he'll respond. The vice chancellor, he first came back and said to me, "Oh, you know, there's nothing going on here. It was just robust scientific debate. You know, there's no conspiracy against Tim Noakes. How is it a scientific debate when four of his colleagues write a letter to the press attacking him in the most unprofessional manner, not giving any evidence in the letter, just saying he's dangerous and he's going to kill people?" And he wouldn't confirm or deny. And I thought, that's an odd response. And to this day, he never explained how that is robust debate. It's not robust scientific debate. It's ganging up. It's actually academic bullying.
Yeah, let's talk more about academic bullying. And we see this in all industries, but it is very much like the old boys club when it comes to academics. And if you dare to shove in the wrong direction.
I have very, very strong feelings about academic bullying in this case. In our book, Law of Nutrition, we started off calling it in 2017, and then we've recently revised it as Real Food on Trial, and I added the subtitle, you know, how the diet dictators try to destroy a distinguished science, and because that's basically what they tried to do. And you talk about an old boys club, and yes, it is very much so. But also in this case, very, very much an old girls club when it came to dietitians who got involved. And in the closing chapter to our book, Professor Noakes and I spoke about all the imponderable. Could his trial have happened if the four professors who wrote that notorious letter, one of them was a dietitian academic who has played a really interesting role in his trial, but always not going straight for the jugular in legal terms. She eventually became a consultant to the HBCSA against him. She didn't see any ethical issue there and still doesn't. Why didn't you try and speak to him colleague to colleague collegially first and do it through scientific channels? Why become a consultant to the HBCSA only after it became very clear that its case against him had no merit from the outset and that it was now terminally flawed? So what does HBCSA do? They don't say, "Sorry, we got it wrong. Sorry to put you through a couple of years of great expense and emotional trauma. We were wrong." What do? They hire an expensive team of outside lawyers that cost them the earth to carry on with a legal case that has no merit. In our last chapter, we say, could this trial have happened without so many academics ganging up on him, bullying him? And, you know, I said it's tempting to think that surely it's not possible for there to be so many South African MDs, dietitians, academics, scientists, all of them out of step except Tim Noakes. But we give all the evidence on the record to prove that not only is it possible, as anything is, but it's probable. And the evidence is uncontested. He certainly isn't the only academic to be bullied by colleagues. I mean, the most tragic outcome was cardiology professor Bongani Mayosi, who ended up dying by suicide in 2018. That was during the Fees Must Fall protest. And he was traumatized by the student protest. You know, he was with them. He supported their right to protest. He told his family what was driving him even deeper into depression was the lack of support from his colleagues. And not only lack of support, but the active aggression and anger from his colleagues. And he wasn't anywhere near as going against dogma as Professor Noakes was. It took me 5 years to get them to respond to me as a journalist. And what did they say? They said, we deny everything. And his legal team tried to get that evidence, tried to have another hearing on the evidence. But of course, the HPCSA wasn't going to allow that because it was damning in the extreme that a professor of dietetics wrote to say, you know, don't worry, and it was in Afrikaans. I think, you know, Moenie bekommerd wees nie, ons het 'n plan vir Noakes. We have a plan for Noakes, and that's all on the record. It was a freedom of information, a PIA, protection of access to information, in South Africa, PIA Act that Professor Noakes's legal team made, and all the ATSA emails and the head of dietetics. And these emails are damning in the extreme. They have a plan for him. That sounds very sinister. Doesn't sound professional.
To the general public, I mean, you know, to the layperson, a body like the Health Professionals Council, you would assume it would be an impartial sort of go-between to get the facts out there with no... Yes. Prove on either side. We just want to get the facts straight.
Very important point you make there, Nikki, because this was supposed to be a hearing against him. And the HPCSA, of course, it must investigate. But the very interesting thing was that among the academic bullies is and was the head of nutrition at Northwest University at the time. And she was so hopelessly conflicted that, you know why she even thought that it was ethically correct for her to be a witness against him. Heaven only knows to this day. And the HPCSA should have looked into his complaint. At the time, they did that, and they found that there was no evidence against him. Okay. So the right thing to have done was to say, okay, we dismiss the complaint. But they didn't do that. And the head of the medical board at the time, because he was a medical doctor registered with them, he has since deregistered, because he hasn't practiced clinical medicine, I mean, at the time for about 15 years. And he'd only kept up his medical registration for research purposes. And the head of the medical board at the time was the professor of medical ethics, and she's also key here. And I became very interested when I saw that, because I'm a graduate of it, not in medical science. I did, you know, English and politics and philosophy, but it's my alma mater. And so she's the head of the medical board. The HPCSA's own rules are that medical doctors who are accused of something must be heard by their peers. And so dietitians are not his peers, but the HPCSA and this the head of the medical board did semantic gymnastics to try and get dietitians onto the board, and so onto the committee hearing the charge against him. And Noakes's legal team had to say to them, hang on a second, dietitians are not his peers. So this was one of the things that I was thinking, you know, why are they so keen to have a dietitian? And one dietitian was hopelessly conflicted. Then they tried to get the head of the dietetics board at the time, and she was the one who was emailing to say, you know, don't panic, don't worry, you know. She was the one who said, don't worry, you know, it's going through and we've got a plan. And eventually they didn't manage to load the panel against him with a dietitian. But the head of the medical ethics at WITS, what does she do? The rules say if there's no evidence, you can look for further evidence if you really think that it's a really serious case. So she had the right to, you know, if she really thought he was public enemy number one and was going to kill people. But, you know, to reasonably think that about Professor Noakes, she would have needed some strong evidence. There wasn't any. They go looking for evidence. And who do they come up with? The author of South Africa's Dietary Guidelines. that Professor Noakes and low carb high fat go up against. And so they ask her to write a report. And she writes a report, and guess what she says? You know, there's no evidence for low carb high fat, which is incorrect. And the dietary guidelines are scientific, which they're not. And so, you know, Professor Noakes is wrong, and he is a danger. And on that basis, they charge him. She's never been a dietitian in practice. Her undergraduate degree was in home economics. And she and the other expert witness, when they did talk to me, they said, you know, he doesn't have expertise in nutrition. You know, he only knows about sports nutrition. And I said to them, but hang on a second. To know about sports nutrition, you have to know about nutrition for all ages, because sports nutrition is not only for adults, it's also for kids. So the question remains, and I'm still not 100% sure, were they operating as proxies, or were they just kind of, you know, ignorant? I don't think that they could all be just ignorant.
So for anyone listening to this, perhaps having paid close attention to the trial and listening to the arguments, maybe from both sides of the story, many individuals are still battling with which way to go. So on one side, there's the diet in the world, dieting methodologies, which are universally difficult for people to sustain. And a lot of us know that it's not a long-term solution. I mean, you don't have to be a healthcare professional to know. You just have to have been on a diet to know. So this is not, you know, most people can't live this way and they don't really work long term. And on the other side, there's mounting evidence that a diet high in healthy fats is extremely beneficial for specific issues and that fat is not the root of all evil. So I think that the real message here is that when you're trying to improve your health, whether you're working with your GP or a dietitian or a nutritionist or any specialist, it's important to find somebody that you can have a conversation with who's not afraid to go down a route for you tailored to what your individual needs are. And I think that's the way healthcare is going in general.
Yes, I can only endorse everything that you say there, Nikki. To me, it's kind of relatively simple, the way forward. I have to say quite honestly that I don't know any low-carb expert who says it's the only way or that animal-based diets are the only way. It has always made common sense to me that if you've been eating one way and you've become seriously ill with a chronic life-threatening disease or even just unwell, it makes just common sense to try a different diet, change the way you eat before you resort to drugs. But also a very important point about low-carb and even ketogenic diets is that these are not diets. These are very much lifestyles.
Agreed.
In fact, one of my best sources of health information, Dr. Zoe Harkham, she's a British researcher. She doesn't even call what she espouses low-carb, high-healthy fat. She calls it eating real food. And yeah. She says when you do eat real food, it automatically and quite naturally is low carbohydrate, high in healthy fats. It very often is naturally, most often is naturally animal based, because that's the way we evolved over millions of years to eat. And I saw a tweet recently from another of my favorite sources, Nina Teicholz, Nina has written a seminal book on the topic, is why butter, meat and cheese belong in a healthy diet. And she tweeted today to say, you know, the big problem with conventional dietary guidelines, the ones that South Africa follows, is that if you follow them properly, you will be deficient in certain nutrients. And she lists the nutrients. It's similar in effect to vegetarian and especially vegan diets. And until South Africa stops slavishly following the U.S. dietary guidelines, and the biggest problem with the U.S. dietary guidelines is that they have a saturated fat subcommittee that keeps telling people that, you know, saturated fat is the devil. It's part of the diet heart hypothesis that saturated fat causes heart disease. I mean, there is no proof. That hypothesis has been completely discredited. And that there is evidence to show that the US Dietary Guidelines Saturated Fat Subcommittee is controlled by a vegetarian activist. And to me, it also makes sense that really diet-related diseases require diet-related solutions, not drugs. With Professor Noakes and his trial, it's very, very much a luta continua, which I used to say to him often. You know, the struggle goes on. He won a battle, but ADSA and the dietitian who reported him and her followers made it very clear very quickly that the war with him and with low carb goes on, and it just leaves hanging in the ether the question, why do they insist on propagating a diet practically for everyone that is not scientific? And the evidence is all there to show that low-carb, high-fat, animal-based diets can work close to magic to reverse all the symptoms of type 2 diabetes and obesity without resorting to drugs. So what more? I mean, very recently, the most exciting research is by a US-based company called Virta Health. It was started by a Danish philanthropist, Sami Inkinen, after he was diagnosed as type 2 diabetic. And he just didn't particularly want to risk his vision and losing limbs. And he started looking into dietary change, and he came across low carb, high fat, and he's now made the treatment available. And Virta Health is currently coming up close to 4 years in a clinical trial showing the benefits of animal based low carb, very low carb, high fat, high healthy fat, in other words, ketogenic diets. And their data, you really can't argue with that data. You can't argue with the facts. And the researchers have said that they don't have any plans at the moment to test non-animal-based, i.e. plant-based ketogenic diets, because they've got too much on their plate, and they're only a certain number of researchers who are available. Any other interests who might want to research that are free to do so. But the thing is that, you know, it's in the end, doctors and dietitians, they are never going to get educated simply by what Professor Richard Feynman once called a self-propagating system, in which people study to pass exams and they teach others to pass exams, but nobody really knows anything. And I know I've incurred the wrath of many doctors and dietitians by saying, you know, all those letters after their name are not any guarantee of intelligence, whether it's EQ or IQ. And, you know, essentially you learn something by doing it yourself, by asking questions, by thinking and by experimenting.
Yeah,
and just upholding dogma is never going to get us anywhere. It's making a lot of money for certain people, and that's one of the drivers. But excuse me, I'm not one of those who believes that all doctors and dietitians who uphold the status quo do so because they're in the thrall or the pay of drug companies or food companies. But the reality is that many of them are.
Marika, this has been a wonderful and insightful and just quite an amazing take on this whole high-fat, low-carb way of living. And I'm hoping it does clear up a lot of questions for many people. for those who haven't read the book, where can they get hold of it? I assume it's available on Amazon, anywhere you can buy a book nowadays.
Thank you for that. It's published by Penguin, and it's available in South Africa on Takealot and exclusive under the title Law of Nutrition Challenging Conventional Dietary Beliefs. And then we updated it to take in the appeal hearing, the second of the HBCSA's two committees that found for him. And we republished it for the international market, also available on Amazon, and it's also available on audiobook by Tantor Media that you can get on Audible. Right. And it's available as ebooks. And the title there is Real Food on Trial, How the Diet Dictators Tried to Destroy a Distinguished Scientist. So thank you for that.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. I'm sure we're going to have many more conversations in the future about many more of these topics.
I hope so. Thank you. Thank you very, very much for the opportunity. And because as I've said, I'm just the messenger here. And I look at the evidence and look at the reliability and integrity, personal and professional, of the doctors and the scientists who are supporting or doing the research. And that's where I get my information, and those are the messages that I try and pass on to people. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thanks again for joining me for another episode of the Reinvent Health Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you find your favorite podcasts. All the links and more information can be found in the episode notes.